All right, hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and today I've got as my guest Mr. John Stetson. Hey there, John.
Hello, Scott. Nice to see you.
Great to have you in town. I'm glad that things happened to kind of stars aligned.
You're
kind of coming over here.
To coincide with my night before program. So how about that?
That's great. That's great. Well, we were actually talking about some interesting topics over here, and I just wanted to kind of turn on the recorder before that we missed some of those things. And
sure.
You were starting just to say something about the... I lost my train of thought. Where you were at that point?
What the heck were we talking
about? About
the guys of so much interest. No, we were talking about the importance, I believe, of being who you are.
That's what it was.
In a we were talking about networking situations.
That's right.
And
when you're walking around performing, you're not looking to necessarily do another trick for a person. You're looking for someone to talk to and engage with.
Exactly. Exactly.
And be yourself.
I like to be perceived, and I don't mean to think as being a presumptuous statement, but I love it when people say to me, "Oh, so do you own this place?"
Yeah. Same thing like with a trade show. You know, they're going to say, so
do you,
work for the company
yeah.
because you know as much as a salesman.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's so very important and makes such a great impact. And of course, that has to do with the way you're dressed, the way you carry yourself, the way you interact and engage with people. But the most important thing in that area would be if you're not naturally that guy, don't try to be that guy. I think the big key words for survival and for business especially in the magic mystery entertainment world, whatever we're calling it this week, are some very important self words. Self-reliance. When I look back at Emerson and Thoreau in these days, I go, wow, my gosh, so many people are looking for empowerment from other performers, other people. There's no substitute for study. There's no substitute for being by yourself, for working on things alone, finding who you are, finding your own niche, finding with clothing, for example. It's not a question of fashion to me. It's a question of style. I'm no longer 28 years old, nor do I have a 28-year-old waist.
Yeah.
So, have a style that is you, that you're comfortable with, that's that's possible clothes you can afford.
Recognize your age and dress like that. You know,
exactly.
I've seen
dress
so many
your
guys,
age, dress your weight.
Dress your weight. I've seen guys on stage, you know, who obviously don't have mirrors, you know,
yeah.
and they're in spandex and they're trying to, you know, be young guys, like dyeing their hair jet black.
So, self-reliance is big. Another big, the two key words are self-respect.
Yeah.
Have respect for who you are and what you do. Please don't confuse that with conceit. but here's the huge one. The huge, huge, huge one. Self-awareness. Be self-aware. Know who you are. Know
yeah.
who you are. Know who you're performing for. Know what your situation is that day. I was at the Mystery Lounge one night. Our place in Boston, and I have really tried to relinquish being hands-on with everything and allow things to sort of move by itself, which is very good. And so I'm rarely there, but we've expanded, you know, rosters a little bit and done some different things. It's been really exciting and really good for everybody. But there's a young gal who loves magic, and she loves comedy, and she runs the show.
Like the MC?
The club management has her there on our night.
Okay.
For example.
And she's deployed by the club?
Yeah.
Okay.
It works out great.
Yeah.
So her name is Andrea, and I love her to death. And I always love our conversations, and she came over and leaned into me and said, "You're not," I was watching a performer, because "you're not loving this guy, are you?" And I said, "Andrea, I'm trying really hard to love him. I just don't love what he's doing." And she turns to me and says, "Can I say something to you that you say to me all the time?" Sure. She goes, "Stop beating yourself up." She goes, "The guy's a douchebag." It's not a term that I use on a regular basis. But I love Andrea, and I love challenging her and falling back and forth, because I learn things when I do.
Yeah.
She's bright, sharp as a tack. I go, "What's a douchebag?" Figuring I might get her to you know, pause. And she goes, without missing a beat, she turns to me and says, someone with zero self-awareness.
Huh.
And I went, whoa.
Good definition.
That is an outstanding definition. And I was at the bar downstairs from the club afterwards, bragging to some of the guys, and Andrea just came up with a beautiful point.
Definition.
A couple of Harvard students, because we're right across from
Harvard,
come in at 11 o'clock at night wearing sunglasses.
Yeah.
And it just was so appropriate to what we were talking about, and I simply said, because the sun never sets in Doucheville.
Yeah,
and there you have it. Like I said, it's not a term I use, but it's now one I understand a whole lot more.
Well, it has, I think, also to do with trick selection. You know, that people, you know, that I think a lot of people, particularly myself and all of us, I believe, included when we're getting involved with magic to begin with, is that we're interested in everything. We want to just find a trick that's going to fool somebody. You're not looking for something that you, you know, at a certain point in your life, you're on that hierarchy of magic that
you define.
You know, getting that peak of self-actualization, that you get to a point where that you know who you are and you're satisfied with who you are and you select your tricks based upon who you are.
Exactly.
And so when you go to a magic convention, you know, it's like, oh, this is kind of a neat little gimmick or a cool little thing, but will it fit? Perfect example. You know, right now that I have loved John Archer's Blank Knight.
Right.
And
I did with the Penn & Teller show, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You got something, nothing, etc.
Yeah.
And, you know, he ends up with the last word being sex, which is not good for me and my corporate audience, so I use the word time. You know, I say, okay, you can take my time or take your time, you know, making your decision.
Sure.
You take the time, there might be something in that, whatever.
There you go. Sure.
But I like the concept, and I like the presentation and all that, so I've been fiddling around with a few other words and whatnot, you know, to fit me. But it's just that the ending of it that I'm not necessarily satisfied with, from the standpoint that it's a sting and it's not me. And I've done it enough times already to think either I'm going to have to change this radically or I'm going to have to leave it out completely. As much as I like it, it's not me, you know, because so you lose, I win, haha, you know, kind of a thing.
Sure.
For an example, in the same routine, or, you know, I've started... one of the things I've added in recently, like for my B show, is Matt King's other rope routine that he taught. You know?
Oh, I remember that.
In which that the basics of that, for the listeners who don't, they're not aware of this, that Matt teaches is that the volunteer wins. You know, you tie the knot to a, or rather, the cut rope into a knot, and then they can pull their knot off the rope. I mean, you pull the knot off, and then you say, okay, now you try it. And they successfully do, and then they can pull the knot off your rope also. So it's, you know, the volunteer wins. I like that with them winning. But then when it comes to Blank Knight, suddenly, you know, you're all losers and I'm the winner.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm kind of thinking as far as either pulling it out or maybe instead of doing a Bill and Lemon, I was talking with John McGrath, a buddy of mine who was visiting from Scotland just here recently, and he had suggested, because he was kind of pointing this out, you know, as a spectator, saying, here, you know, this is, I don't see this as being you. That's why you need to have a director, you know, someone who's actually, you know, watching, standing back and looking. And so he had suggested that. He said, you know, the Bill Lemon is good, but he said, what if perhaps that the bill ends up as being that last one inside the envelope? So in other words, everybody, you know, you lose, and the person who wins is, oh, is this your bill, by the way? And Nathan's got their signed bill, it's
right.
Got the same serial number and everything, you know, that you had gotten earlier, so instead of being inside of a bill, it's the last one, and that could be like a way of concluding the show then as well. I thought that's kind of a different take on it and a nice presentation.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. I like that a lot. But also, when you talk about the bank night kind of thing, Richard Osterlund's routine, he's done something to really take the sting out of it, which I know it's on his DVD and stuff, so I don't know how much we should be talking about it. But he's got a very nice way, and it's just that. It's not the bite. It's not the bite.
There's a trick out also that Steve Ragazzi sells through Sean Farquhar. You know, it's called "I Hate Kids," and it's essentially, you know, three coin on or coin purses. You know, when you squeeze it, you know that you pull out a bill and you say, "Okay, I'm gonna." You're going to lose. You know, he tells, you know, his presentation, but that is Steve, you know, and it fits perfectly for him the way he, you know, mishandles kids, you know, kind of in a polite way, you know. But it doesn't for most of us. And so the another guy here locally, Gene Probus, had a little twist on that, which he said, I'm going to do everything I can to help you win, as opposed to what Steve is saying, you're a loser, kid. I'm going to show you why you're a loser. You know, and it's funny the way that he would do it, but again, it's not for me. And so what Gene would do is just to say, I'm going to help you do everything you can to win, because there's a $5 bill on one of these, and you're going to get to keep that $5 bill. Choose whichever one you do. He does. He gives him the five. He said, that's great. You win. Before you, you know, you could have, just to show you that there weren't fives in the other one, here's a 50, here's a 100, you know. So, but it still has a little bit of a sting because, but then it has to do with expectation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost something that you can do like in a presentation if you're doing a talk for a company. You know, so your expectation is, you know, going to work for this certain salary. If you get a bonus, that's going to be something extra. But, you know, you've agreed to come on and be paid for this particular thing. I like, you know, having a different way of an angle like that. And you'd be satisfied with the $5, wouldn't you? Yep, I would. Okay, it's great. But, you know, could have 50, could have 100. Other guys are getting paid others.
But that also brings up the point of the double-edged sword of these, I shouldn't say cookie cutter because it sounds like I'll say turnkey routines people buy now. That are something from someone's act that they feel. A lot of times I think people sell them, say, because people are going to take them otherwise, so I might as well sell them and make them out.
Yeah.
Whatever the justification is, that's neither here nor there. The point is how well it works for you and how it differentiates you from somebody else and where you're putting on someone's personality. I mean, I was fortunate when I was young to have a few lessons with slight eating.
But don't you look like Frankenstein at the end because you got this guy's arm, somebody's head,
exactly.
Someone else's foot?
Exactly. Or as a few friends of mine will joke, yes, any act called for. But the slight eating thing, I noticed that I changed my speech pattern and my posture when I'd be doing a routine that he was teaching me. As many slight now, I was not. I mean, there are so many people who are great, hardcore slight eating students. I just took a few lessons. Yeah. I was not one of those guys. I don't pretend to be.
I feel almost left out because everybody I know has taken a lesson.
Yes.
If I was a slight eating student, oh, were you a real student?
I took a couple lessons. I took a couple lessons. I was not a student.
Yeah.
Not saying I didn't learn.
Yeah.
But with these routines now, I remember one of the first ones like that I was interested in years ago is when Mike Cave needed the like coat hangers,
yep,
kind of thing. You know, anyone who did that would be turning into Mike. But I saw a lot of guys take it and run with it. Back then,
Invisible Ink. I remember doing a silent routine. Do you remember that?
Tom Hayes from Boston had a great routine. Mike Bent. It developed into a great routine. Well, Mike has that Midas touch.
Yeah, he does.
Anything he touches,
it's so funny.
He can take and just make his.
Yeah.
It's great. So I just think it's a question of being careful of when you're doing these, buying these turnkey routines.
And not falling into that trap of doing the presentation and the pattern that comes
sure.
with it.
Sure. Because it just doesn't fit. Because it just probably doesn't fit you. It's, you know, when I'm looking at, you know, Tom Bragoon, I said, like, you know, I don't think his pants would fit me, so why should his act? You know?
That's a good point. It's very good for him. It's very funny.
Yeah, it is perfect. It's created for him.
I saw a DVD just this last week again. You know, John McGrath of Scotland visiting, and he showed me this DVD of Giovanni Rivera. Salt and Silver, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And in the presentation, he was just, you know, doing it silently or to music. And John said, why do you think he's doing this? This works so much better if you're talking. The routine is perfect. He said, because John's a coin guy, and he said, I've tried to see if there are a couple other moves, but he said, every gesture, everything is perfect. He said, this is the best routine. But he said, I put, you know, talking into it. He said, why do you think that Gio does that? I said, look, I've known Gio since, like, 87 or something. I said, the reason, I think, is that he doesn't want to create a clone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put something on there, people are more likely to start doing it his way. Forcing them.
This is
to
the first
own idea.
This is the first I've heard of it. But I would agree with not having seen it. I would agree with you completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I would. And he is, as we know, one of the most clever guys out there when it comes to this kind of thing. And it's not so much as him. This would be my take, I think it's not so much as him protecting his own material for him. I think that's he creating a great service for whoever purchases.
Yes,
this work. I think it's great.
So people can take it and make it their own.
Yeah,
there should be more DVDs, perhaps like that, which if they're doing, rather than going on the street saying, you know, well, what are we supposed to learn from David Blaine? I mean, he certainly doesn't have any pattern or presentation you're stealing.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, my take on Blaine originally, I must say, since the first remember the first Doug Henning special?
Yeah, I do. Cool. His very first trick with John Cornish's Vanishing Nickel.
You betcha, and he pulled Bill Cosby out of the jukebox with that and the whole thing. And but the thing is, that was an event. that I looked forward to before it aired, while it was on, and after it. I felt equally jazzed. And I know I'm speaking for a legion of people who are, you know, who are around today. I felt the same way with Blaine. And I was very, very excited when before, I was excited during, and after. For a couple of different reasons. Well, a lot of reasons. But one is, one of my favorite Vernon quotes ever was, the greatest travesty in magic in the last half of the last century was its total trivialization based on contrived presentation.
Say that one more time.
The trivialization of magic based on contrived presentation. Now, hey, I'll say guilty as charged. I did things years ago that were of that ilk, I would think, would have a somewhat contrived presentation, and hopefully had grown through it and saw the error of my ways. He also brought magic back to its original points of power and dare I say, religion. This whole thing, and it was great. Now, what I did not anticipate at the time was the fallout, which are what I call the Blaniacs, which is the basis for a lot of what we're seeing today. And it's so funny because Blaine is already a generation ago, so now a lot of guys are doing the zombie presentation. And I'm not saying that David is a zombie, but what I'm saying is, you know, they're people who were influenced by him. Same with people who were influenced by music, by acting styles, by everything else. So
that's true.
It's what young people do. It's a different generation. It's a different world when we look at things now. And there are things in magic that make me want to throw up in my mouth. But I also have to realize that these are the times that I live in. I can choose to be a part of it or become a hermit.
Or embrace.
Yeah. And now, it's just something you say, going to magic conventions and looking for things or ideas, I'm having more fun than I've ever had at magic conventions. I specifically go just to see my friends.
Yeah.
And I can look and say,
sound like Rick Mao.
I'd like to see this.
Yeah.
Well, that's an honor to sound like Rick. I appreciate that. But I go, and I'll go, yeah, I'd like to see this, or I wouldn't like to see this. And it's nothing personal.
Right. But you can make a choice. You don't feel like you have to catch everything.
Yeah, I do not have to catch everything. I go now. I sleep at them, which is something I never used to do.
Take a nap in the afternoon.
I have the greatest time in the world now. Because, it took me a very long time to know who I am and to know what works for me and what I want to or what I want to see. I can differentiate between a hobbyist's interest in this stuff and what I do for a living. And what I do for a living is a lifestyle. It's not a thing.
It's not a career.
I was a closet mentalist from being a little boy, but in that era, we were all told, "Oh, you can't do mind reading until you have gray hair." What did I ship? Probably about 95. 96, something like that. Which, when I decided to take the whole plunge to the other side,
felt like okay, the hair's gray enough that I can start.
Yeah, yeah. And but now it's interesting. Now I'm seeing some great ideas for magic effects, things that are bordering on like the whole idea of real magic and whatnot. And I'm going, wow. So it's almost like a pendulum shifting back over to that area. Yeah. In certain small aspects of my work, and I'm loving it.
Are you including magic in part of your presentation more now than you did before, or still just psychic and mentalism?
Well, so much of what I was doing was what I've considered, pure mentalism, which it does not include predictions, as far as I'm concerned.
That's the hardest thing about mentalism. I don't want to finish a show and people say, "Well, it's just a series of predictions."
So much of it, it's all it is, and with virtually every every prediction, it's very hard to not make it look like a magic trick. You can do it as far as influence. I'm bringing you to a certain place. I'm looking for an end result. The best way to predict future is to create your own future. There's that foxhole that where I will jump into. But I also do a lot of customized presentations.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's a lot easier to say, yeah, I'll just do that than not.
Yeah.
I'm blessed that I work in so many different areas that some nights I can go full tilt in one direction, the other, but it still encompasses facets of my personality and who I am and the things that I want to do. I can do seance, I can do my ladies only psychic parties. I can go into trade show mode, I can do close up, and I have a great deal of material for my stand-ups. It just comes from time. I'm not bragging or anything. Right. It's just this is every day. This is what I look at. And the beautiful thing is not to add, but to eliminate. You know, you can look at guys like Eugene Berger years ago, I think, said on a tape or something, you know, my repertoire is gone from 30 effects to 20. So you could say I'm growing. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But that's a valid point.
It really is.
That is a huge point, and that's something that I think was lost to a lot of people at the time when he was saying it. But God bless Eugene, he was absolutely correct. And one thing that we were discussing, you know, a direct connection here is when someone takes something from someone else. Or even buys one of these cookie cutter routines. So, you know, I'm not calling it stealing. Someone is buying the routine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So now you should have the right to perform it.
But this is what it is. What are you really buying? And, or, what are you really stealing? If it's a move or trick, if it or a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
What they're stealing isn't the trick, and it isn't the joke.
Yeah.
What they're stealing is your reaction, the reaction you get from it. They're stealing my laugh, they're stealing my applause, they're stealing my... That's what they want. And I don't just mean mine, I mean yours, or whoever else is the person being taken from, stolen, ripped off, or even when they buy things. You know, I don't... You know, you look at the effect of, say, like Steve Spill's Mind Reading Goose, which is brilliant, but people want the reaction Steve gets from it.
Well, they see that. Once again, I think everybody's looking for that holy grail of magic, and if you see the reaction someone gets, it's like, I want that also, you know. It's like, I think, the reason that, you know, kids start up a garage band, because they see some, you know, rock star, then they want to have that kind of image, you know. So
well, we all did that, you know. Yeah. So many of us had, you know, Doug Henning hair, and then, you know,
clothing and
sneakers and all, and then we would go one way and go another way. It's all part of young people finding
themselves. And the earlier years, I think, you know, Blackstone, you know, whomever, Thurston or whatever, you know, way back when. I mean, people would always...
Look at all those guys. Well, you know, why does the magician wear tails? Basically, because Robert Houdin.
That's right.
They're all still...
In the drawing room.
Yeah, and the interesting thing was all he was doing is wearing the clothes of the people at the time in that particular situation. I mean, there's a fellow who does a classy magic show kind of thing, and but he's wearing a morning suit. Well, you don't wear a morning suit in the evening.
So that doesn't mean mourning like, you know, you're mourning the loss of someone? It's not that kind of mourning.
Well, you know, the whole concept is a mourning suit.
I know
suit.
What you're talking about.
And it's the same way years ago. And you know how much I love Max.
Yeah.
You know how much I love Max Maven and how I grew up around him, and he's such a great influence of mine. But someone said, well, yeah, it's like when we see Max speaking in Japan, for all we know, he sounds like Gomer Pyle over there. You know, I don't speak Japanese. I don't know.
Right.
Now, I doubt that. I seriously doubt that's the case. But just being the fact that it's being brought up is an interesting thing for us to study. It's like, how is he being seen? Because the whole key to all of this is how we allow ourselves to be seen. In our professional lives and our personal lives as well.
Well, notice when you came down, you know, and you're wearing a coat, you know, and you're dressed, you know, and you're professional, and you know, I'm in shorts. I'm, you know, dressed more casual. And you're dressed more in business attire. Of course, if you're in a situation where that you might have, you know, some of your clients that might see.
Yeah.
And also,
so I,
you know,
I left my, you know, Freemason T-shirt upstairs. You know.
Yeah.
But
I was going to talk about conventions. How do you select conventions? You said that you go to ones just in order to see friends, and that's something that, by the way, takes a while. I mean, you're not going to see a lot of friends until you start attending conventions year after year, and after a period of time, you know, that you will see people who will just attend these.
Well, it's...
like Magic in the Rockies or something.
Well, first of all, Magic in the Rockies is
the
ultimate magic convention there is.
They had called me to book me the last 2 years, and I've had something that's just not worked.
I because I have not been able to be there in the last almost 8 or 9 years. And I used to go every year, and
everybody tells me it is
awesome. It is. It's the greatest. One of the reasons, it's because the guests are, you know, are just as their guests, not attendees, you know.
Yeah.
They're treated that way. In the performer's contract, it says they'll mix and mingle
sure.
with people and not, you know.
Of course, you go hide in the room.
You know, right? Everyone occasionally, you know, Jay Sankey shows up. But other than that, you know, but we're all that way sometimes.
Yes.
You know, you just don't feel like it. But, you know, it's encouraged, and everybody mixes, and it's a great size. And the fact that they have the public shows that has funding to do it. So their budget
is... Right, they have a city that sponsors it, and they go all out.
Yeah. Their budget is several times what the average
most would be.
Magic Club convention would be.
Mm-hmm.
That, and the fact everybody loves it, and their reputation is so good. And Lou and Tim, you know, the primary guys... They send an email to, and I'm on the list, but they go, who should we get this year? Who should we get? And what's the mix? And the whole thing's going up. And you've got, you know, two of my dearest friends, Doc and Eric, involved in every aspect of it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so Magic in the Rockies is just the exception to all magic conventions. However, getting back to how do you choose them, I feel it's the private sector as opposed to organizations are the ones that put on the best conventions. I will, you know, a Magic Live, the Genie Gathering. First of all,
as opposed to like the IBM TOM, PJM,
they have a little more riding up. TOM is a little different.
Thank you.
Get that homey. You get that homey feeling, and it's always a great gathering, and people always have a lot of fun. Well, you Texas guys, I spent all the time I spent with Johnny Brown and pressed the guitar and everything. Gosh, not only did you magic, you guys got laid. It was incredible. That's why I love Texas. You know, the magic did not mean you don't have sex. I think that is fabulous. And that's why I have all those great memories.
You're not usually exclusive.
Well, I have all those great memories of hanging out with the guys. So, you know, and that was like when I was doing the auto shows and things, so you'd be around for 10 days.
Yeah.
And so you get to hang out with everybody and visit and
spend more quality time.
I've been so fortunate that I've done so many different things in my past that I've met, you know, I knew the cruise ship guys, you know, from the auto shows, the trade show gang.
Right.
So when you talk about seeing friends, I mean, I can't swing a dead cat without bumping into someone
who
I love.
Well, that's part of the problem, I think, with a convention where that you do see so many people then, John, that you're going to, I'll get together with you later. We'll see you.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you. It was a good how about dinner?
You know, I put it in Magic Live.
Yeah.
We go, hey, how are you? Nice to see you. Great. Blah, 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 blah. You're making crossing paths.
Right.
And I want to say, I'm going to go on record and say that in Magic Live years, we just had a 4-hour visit.
Right now.
That's it. Goodbye.
Yeah. There were so many people. I said, Costa Kimlet and Gio and others. It's like literally just past the hallway.
Yeah.
Let's get together tonight. Yeah. We never set a time. And so it's just like you never see him again.
I mean, one of my closest friends I think you know is Tim Felix.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
great.
We kind of have a balance there. It's like, yep, what's Timmy doing? Where is he? You know, we don't have to be together all the time. But where is he? Right.
Yeah.
Everyone else, I always go, when we see him, we catch, you know, catch as catch can. I walked into Magic Live the first night. I didn't get beyond the escalators where I bumped into one of my idols, my dear friend Gil Eagles, who I love tremendously. Basically a bunch of PEA guys. With Ken Weber and Jerry Cambridge. And, you know, drop names or anything, but it was a group of like five of us. We started talking, and Barry Richardson, and it was so great that it's like, I didn't need to go anywhere. I didn't need to look for anything else. We just said, hey, want to go for coffee? And we did, and we sat for four hours. And that was the whole first night of the of the gathering.
That's the way to do it. There's so often that I see, you know, people who are, I know from Houston, my hometown, you know, say, hey, let's go to dinner. You know, we can do that when we get home. You know, I always think when I'm at a convention, shouldn't you kind of see people that you don't have an opportunity to see on a daily basis?
Or you feel like saying to the guys at home, hey, we don't do that at home. Why should we do it here? Happened to me once at a golf course. I hung out with. I there's a guy. He just never spoke to me, and no big deal. But I was in an airport in Tokyo, and he comes over and goes, hey. I go, hey, you don't talk to me there. Why talk to me here?
Yeah, I'm your best friend now. So you're the only friend in Tokyo.
But yeah, and so those things are, the conventions like that are great. I'm finding with IBMs and SAMs, first of all, they're having a hell of a time getting people to go.
Well, membership and conventions in general, I think that's true. They're trying to find, well, part of the problem, I think, with the general conventions, if you will, is that you are having just that it's too general, and you're trying to appeal to everybody, you know, to the youth, to the you know, those who are more mature, those who are close-up guys on stage, you're trying to have, you know, some illusionist, or, you know, whatever it's going to be as far as the mix, as opposed to, let's say, like Mindvention, where it's all, you know, on that, or the, what's the con, Magic Con, I guess?
You know, yeah, I've not been to one of those, but I hear they're fabulous.
Exactly, close-up kind of a thing. Of course, the 4F convention, you know, it's close-up. Different things which are specialized.
And, of course, VISM has always been special. You know, that's
there are certain things like that. Magic Live, and if you know, but they have a completely different kind of a format.
Yeah.
It's not the cookie cutter. We're going to have contests, we're going to have dealers, we're going to do this, and this, you know.
Well, it's interesting. And I don't want to open a can of worms here, get someone angry at me, but you're not, it's not being run by a meeting planner, so you're not dealing with a professional on that side of things.
Right.
For the most part.
Right.
For the most part. I'm sorry to generalize. Same thing goes for talent producing shows. You're not dealing with people who have had a great deal of professional experience.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, just because someone, you know, you get a couple of good acts putting together doesn't mean it's a good show.
Right.
And then you get people who are on the shows for political reasons and whatnot. And of course, their budgets, and you have to be conscious of that. They can't, you know, they can't just throw away all that. And I love the whole idea of nurturing, you know, the young guys, but especially go to an SAM convention now. It's all these kid events, so it's kids and their parents.
That's true.
I don't know them.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. All right, we're going to take this quick break over here. We're at dinner. We're going to order our dinner, so I'm going to put this on pause here just a second. All right, well, we've got our dinner ordered over there, and we were just talking about conventions and everything. Mm. So you were saying that you were at the Magic Symposium? I think we were just starting to get there.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about Penn Jillette doing a talk that he didn't know he was going to be doing 100 years ago at one of the Adam Fleischer Magic Symposiums. It was when Penn & Teller first started doing their off-Broadway show. And everybody, there was great interest. And all the magicians were excited to go. And at intermission, Penn found out he was doing a talk.
Surprise, surprise.
So, yeah, and so that didn't go over real well, I think. But he did come out afterwards and say, a couple things he said was kind of interesting. One was, he goes, look, I have a date tonight, and if it's a choice between getting laid or talking to you guys, what do you think I'm going to do? He goes, besides, Teller's the magician. He's the one you want to talk to.
Yeah.
Which is something I don't think he'd say these days. But that was the MO back then.
Yeah.
And then he goes, but I'll tell you one thing I don't like about you guys. The fact that you don't have taste in what you do. And what he meant by that was, we're not selective in the kind of things we like. Anything that falls under the broad umbrella of magic, we just glom onto, which is
if it has those five letters in that order, it's magic, you'll buy it and do it.
Yeah. He goes, you know, I love music, but I won't go across the street to see, you know, whoever
XYZ.
He mentioned. Yeah. XYZ, their band, I see you're going to get in trouble no matter what. You're already here, you see? You can't.
Or ABC, they're probably a band.
Yeah, they're a band. They were a band, too. So you can't win. But anyway, he pointed that out, and he goes, you know, you guys will drive 20 minutes out of the way to go to a place called Magic Dry Cleaners, you know, just because it's
magic. It sounds cool, yeah.
Just because it's magic. course, that being said, Michael Weber will drive 2 hours to go get his haircut by Dean Dill, but I think that's a different story. That's a different story for a different day.
That's a cool place, though.
It is a cool place. You know, that's a little different. Yeah, that's a place worth going to.
It is.
That is good taste.
He's done my hair.
Well, he's cut the best.
Yep.
And it is fun hanging out there. I've been there a couple times, but I know a lot of the guys who have the regular Fridays over there.
Well, over there it was like on a Wednesday, and I didn't realize, but that was like the time that that's their normal get together. You know, half dozen guys, Pete Byron, and everybody was hanging out. And it's like, this is the day we normally just happen to be here at the right time.
Pete is such a great guy.
He is.
Pete Byron knows so much.
Mm-hmm.
And was privy to so much years ago, and with his connection with England and Ken Brook, and Seabrook was his best. But Seabrook would keep a copy of his act, all the props, in Pete's garage. So when he came to the States, he didn't have to carry any luggage. He would just go to Pete's house.
Because he'd always go work at the castle, several times.
Yeah, he would have the suitcase would be there with duplicates of all his props.
Huh. Did not know that story.
And, of course, that reminds me of, you know, the great Morris Vogel story?
No.
Oh. Well, Morris, bless him.
Who's another medalist, by the way, for those of you guys who are not into history, by the way, the blindfold, big steel. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a very big
Russian
star.
Thing,
and,
you know,
he was
Maurice Vogel.
Yeah, and his son-in-law, Christopher Woodward, and Richard Mark wrote a very good book about him.
Hmm.
That I know because it sits at my bedside.
So what's the story?
He would do, as many of us would know, the Russian roulette routine.
Right.
And he would have crates with the rifles and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his MO would be, you know, Scott, I'm going to be back soon in the States. And so it'd be great if I could just keep the rifles here with you. Would that be okay? And
okay, agree? Sure.
You get a telegram the next week saying, Scott, show in South Africa, rush me the rifles to this address. And I don't know exactly how many of these freight charges he ever paid for. It was just sort of his way of getting his house guest, the person who he was the house guest of, to pay for the forwarding of his big giant luggage, which he didn't have to carry with him, or pay the expense of having it sent somewhere.
That's an interesting story.
One of those legendary show business stories. Rush me the rifles.
Yeah,
was the big thing.
Yeah, as well before the internet or anything or cell phones and whatnot. As far as saying, hey, well, how can I pay? You pay for this? Just send me the PayPal or whatever. And I'll take care of it covered over there. So it's a whole other minute. Yeah. So anyhow, that he was quite a well-known mentalist.
Great
day. 60s or 70s, I guess. 70s, probably.
50s.
Oh, that goes
late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Okay.
I think the first time I saw him perform would have been at a magic convention. He was at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, I think it's 77, probably.
Yeah.
That was a great gathering. And another one of those legendary conventions. Conventions. My first national convention was the 1974 SAM convention in Boston. And the fellow who produced it was a guy named Ed Rosenthal.
I remember Ed.
Remember Ed? And he retired to Arizona.
Was he in Phoenix,
Yeah,
sure.
He was a Boston guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know he was.
And he had that picture of him.
Is he an attorney?
I believe he was in the hearing aid business.
Oh, really? Okay.
Now, there was a picture of him. Well, I wish I could reach out and shake every one of your hands.
Yes.
Welcome you to Boston.
Yes.
It was a very personable ad in the whole thing. And the SAM in Boston at that time had quite a treasury.
Hmm.
And between that and the national and everything, they put on great, there used to be a great regional convention there called Magical, which was an annual event. And
collectors. Is that right?
No. The Magical was the local.
Not the Magic Hall.
Almost like the version of Magic in the Rockies. And these shows were originally produced by, I mean, Ed Rosenthal was involved toward the end of it. He produced the Magical, so I am actually going somewhere.
Okay.
Herman Hansen, who was a legendary performer, I say legendary because he's the first one to really combine music with magic in a performance. I mean, years ago, Heller, not to be confused with Keller,
yes,
would
right.
play the piano. Yeah. And
Bill Howson wrote a book on Heller.
Yes. And Vernon also said, I thought the greatest thing for a magic act would be a magic. He does the magic and then he plays the piano and leaves. And I thought, that sounds kind of dumb. But now that I look at it, I go, no, that makes perfect sense to me.
The older you get, the more you align with
design. I'd love to see an act like that. It would be great. But Herman Hansen was the original. He did an act, a vaudeville act, Hansen and his Magic Maids. And there was a great book written about him, John Zwiers wrote, called The Magic Man. And in the book were all the Magical shows that he produced, all the lineups.
Yeah.
So you read who... I love this book, and the book came out in 1974. I remember, to this day, I every year, I'm sure, I pull that book down, and I look at those Magical shows and kind of dream about them. But Herman Hansen was also the stage manager for Howard Thurston.
Mm, okay.
And taught Jane Thurston her magic and was Thurston's understudy.
I didn't know that.
And all that. And then when the Thurston show went after his stroke and he passed, he went to work for Holden, who owned Holden's Magic
Holden's
in New York,
sure.
But opened the Boston branch.
Oh, they had one there too, okay.
And he ran that and was involved in the local magic scene as well for many, many years. And he was a very nice, very kind man. And boy did he know magic. He knew magic. Great stuff. But Ed Rosenthal sort of cut his teeth with Herman and learned how to produce shows, you know, with Herman Hansen. And he put on a magic convention. And that was right when the magic boom was going on. That convention was July, and Doug Henning opened the magic show May 15th, 1974, I think. This convention was in July, and it was right when a huge Time magazine article was out about magic, and Derek Dingle was on, Barbara Walters, and it was the magic time.
Yeah.
And if these guys were not on the show, they were at the convention. So for a kid, that was a wonderful thing.
1974 in Boston.
And I just pray that it is the same way for a lot of these young guys now. I had the pleasure of going to brunch at the Magic Castle with a woman who does some consulting work for me. And her son, bright fellow, bright young guy, he's 11, magic nut.
Mm-hmm.
Being at the Magic Castle, seeing it through his eyes, his first visit.
His first visit?
Yes. Just was the most exciting thing for me.
I would love to see that to someone like that.
It made me feel like $1 million.
Sure.
And that great feeling, and I just pray that young guys have that same thing now, and the internet doesn't cloud
it
or take away from it, but...
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's the time they live in. It's the time I live in. You know, we're here.
Yep, you have to embrace it, like we were talking about earlier on in the conversation.
That's it. I'm not running. I'm embracing it.
Yeah.
You know? And you were talking about before email and PayPal for everything. When we first started in this business, of course, you know, remember people used to write letters?
Letters? Yeah. Now they came in. They don't even teach cursive.
And all this stuff.
Yeah. You'd make a long-distance phone call or something, you know. In fact, I remember... I think it was 1981, whenever that they had the convention, maybe it was 83, the IBM convention in Hawaii. And Bob Brown had given a lecture on advertising and promoting himself, because it was Bob and Brenda, and they were touring the world. And one of the things that they did was that he would make a phone call. He would, first of all, fax information to like a hotel or a casino in India or Monaco or someplace, and then he would follow up within the next few days to ask for the manager to say, did you receive my information? Well, the fact that you were getting this long-distance call, you got this long-distance fax, first of all, that they'd spent some money to do, and then it cost a lot to make these long-distance calls to talk directly. It's like, this guy must be able to think I'm important, you know, enough, and maybe he must be pretty important because he must have enough money to afford to, you know, to make these kinds of calls just kind of, you know, whenever, you know, any time of the day or whatever. And then he would get booked, you know, to do a lot of shows.
You just hit the nail on the head, Scott. That guy must think I'm important.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we convey
that today
in this age?
In day of email and this technology.
I'll tell you one of the. I'll tell you one way.
What do you do?
Go back. I'm trying. Okay, you're okay. Now I get the memory problems. I can remember everything there, and I'm doing a memory program next week. So that's very, very good. But there, Derek Hughes. I was just at the Louisville Magic Festival we had this year.
Yeah, were you involved with that?
Oh yeah,
I'll talk about that in a minute.
That was great. But Derek Hughes was there, and a young guy who cut his teeth in Boston, a Harvard student, Harrison Greenbaum, who's really good. And there were a couple others who were on the show. And I'm going, wow, I'm glad I'm not a comedy magician. These guys are really, really good. They're together. The thing, it's fabulous. It really is fabulous what they're doing. Derek Hughes, I gave him some notes on his show 5-6 years ago. And he's had a lot of flight time since then. Derek Hughes sent me a handwritten note. When's the last time a young guy sent you a handwritten note? When's the last time anyone has sent you a handwritten note?
I send them out.
I do too.
Yeah, I have postcards that whenever I'm finished the show, that I will send back to a client, and will, because I know they probably still have inboxes someplace or an in-basket, or if not, it goes on their desk or somehow or another they get it.
Yeah.
That it's just a note saying, hey, I really enjoyed performing for you. But you're right. I think that those handwritten notes mean a lot.
Yep, and it's, you know, it's the same thing as performing. Is performing magic, compulsive magic particularly, give people, you know, what do people want? They want a feeling of importance. People want to feel important.
Sure.
And so allow them to feel important as part of your performance. That's great. That's great. There were so many of us, and I'll include myself in here, in the 1980s, who's the central point of all our act would be like a burnt bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it would go on for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Or a crushed watch that went on for 20 minutes. Yeah. Or this, or, you know, the destroyed property, spectators standing there waiting for a stunt to come back. And so few of us were actually good enough actors to convince an audience and that guy for a moment that he was not getting that back. And, you know, it gets back to what we were discussing with contrived presentation. It gets back into that whole headset. Now, some people were brilliant at this. Some people today are still brilliant at that. You know, when I look at a peel and a lemon today.
We just got our salad. And
we're living.
Bread. Okay,
we are living.
That's
this is
delicious.
Great. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that. I'm sorry, your name is?
Virginia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. When I look at Bill and the Lemon, I look at Barry Richardson.
Why is that?
Because it's elegant. Everything Barry has is such, it's an elegant solution to a problem.
Yeah.
And that's what I just love to see. I love to see precision. I love to see elegance. I love to see simplicity. Effects that are, that you can follow.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, Al Baker, I think, was the one who said, if someone ever broke into the Louvre and painted a mustache on the Mona Lisa or, you know, or a Van Gogh, I know exactly who the culprit would be. It'd be one of those magicians who keep trying to improve tricks that don't need improvement. So well written and so right. Shall we shut off while we chew?
Yeah, that's probably not a bad idea. So we can we'll get back to this here a little bit later then. But you guys won't miss us at all. You'll pick right up. All right, we'll take a break here to get back to our listeners just after we finish our salad course. Yes, we were talking about conventions, I think, you know, a while ago, and you were saying something then about, not Bob Cassidy, but about Ross Johnson.
Oh.
Yes.
Ross Johnson, to me, is, Ross is the man for many, many reasons.
Okay.
Professionally, personally, Ross is my role model. You know, what would Ross do?
WWR.
Yeah, he's a consummate performer. He is the classic, I guess you could say old school mentalist.
All right, well, we have to take another break over here. That's right.
More food has arrived.
That's right. We will get back to you.
You doing well?
Okay, we're finishing up dinner, and back to Ross Johnson.
Oh, Ross.
You were saying, yes, so you say he was a great guy, and why is it that you idolize him so that?
Oh, yeah, he is.
Where do you begin?
Idol is a word that I would use. Well, Ross is the classic mentalist, if there is such a thing.
Yeah.
Everything is elegant. His moves are beautiful. Of course, I don't mean magic moves. I just mean the way he moves across the stage, the way he works with an audience. He's one of the few guys who should do blindfold.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say should do it?
Well, most people don't do it right.
Do you do a blindfold?
I did a blindfold. I worked with a blindfold a lot. If I'm doing one now, it'd be in a hospitality suite, or there for several hours. I don't think I'm very good at it.
Let me back up. You're doing a hospitality suite. You're working like an intimate group, like you said, not like a stage environment.
Well, really. Yeah, like we're sitting here at a table,
yeah.
10, 12 people around you.
Huh.
Blindfold's a great thing to do.
You don't do it like with tape and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, sure. Right. Tape it all up, get me in here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, this is after having established a relationship
sure.
with them. Interesting thing about blindfold, there are a few people who can wear the blindfold and fully convey who they are and wear it for a long period of time.
Uh-huh.
Ross is one of those people. Gil Eagles is another one of those people.
Doc Gopher.
And, yep, Doc can do it. You know, Doc's one of my brother. And I don't mean to leave him out of the equation. It's just I don't see Doc wearing the blindfold for as long as these guys. That's why.
Oh, I see
that's
what you're
why,
saying. I get
that's
it.
Why I didn't put him in there.
Yeah.
Like Jeremy Cambridge will wear it for 45 minutes.
Really?
In the course of his show. And there are several things going on while doing it. But a lot of these guys, you know, just the way they're holding their head, the way the whole, they can see.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience can knows they can see.
Hmm.
It reminds me of a Bob Sheets story years ago. We're driving around with the late, great Bob Reed.
Yeah.
And Bob was, you know, just a wonderful guy and a wonderful magician. So funny. We all loved him, of course.
Yeah.
So Bob, you know, Bob is Bob. Sheets, he's scattershot all over the place and thinking
right.
in different ways. And we had to bring... Basically, Bob's point was, hey, if you're going to do blindfold, you're going to let him smash you in the face. You're going to let him hit you, man. You're going to get hit. You're going to get hit. You're going to get, you know, without getting into the whole Bob Reed story of what happened that day. But it was like, his thing was, he goes, and they will. And they, you know, working these street fairs and all these kind of things. You've got to be some guy. You're blindfolded. He wants to make sure you're blindfolded.
Yeah.
And other people will do things
you're physically
to you. And,
okay.
and you know. But then again, you're throwing out the challenge to them.
Sure.
You're telling them you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Prove it.
Yeah, because he does that blindfold card set.
Yeah, which is
classic.
Is so great. But Gil Eagles, once again, elegance, and he's a gentleman, and he can wear that mask for so long and still carry and hold the audience for the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you lose a lot when your eyes are not visible.
Yeah.
There was one beautiful time with Ross Johnson, just getting back to him, and he was doing question and answer with people, and a woman from the audience says, my God, I think he's crying over that blindfold.
Huh.
Wow. You know.
Was that powerful?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that powerful. He's the best. He's doing a show in Chicago on the 25th of October at the Main Stage Theater. And I went out for it last year, and I am going back out for it again.
Yeah.
Ross is a great friend. I speak to him weekly anyway. Anytime I get a chance to see Ross perform, it's magnificent. You know, Ross was actually at Mystery School last year teaching, and this was advertised,
right.
teaching his question and answer. I've done question and answer for over 20 years using various methods. But of course, methodology for Q&A is nothing.
Yeah,
it's nothing.
I know. I know the method. I tried. Yeah, but I just can't sell it.
Well,
it's like you're essential.
There are a lot of different ways. But with sorry, I just lost my train of thought. With who's doing Q&A there?
You're saying Ross Johnson was doing Q&A, and that you were going to be going and.
He was teaching his Q&A. Teaching it at the mystery school. And I said, "Now, okay, I know Ross. I've seen it many times. Methodology, okay. You know, I can tell you how it's done the same way. You know, the Magic Club guy would probably say, yes, she's in the base somehow. Yeah, well, you show me, cowboy, because I don't know.
Yeah, it's a puzzle.
She may be in there, but I don't know. But anyway, Ross, the thing that shocked me is how few people would go there for such a small amount of money to learn how, in a once-in-a-lifetime teaching experience.
Mm-hmm.
I was there, Michael Weber was there, and Paul Beagle was there. There were some other people, you know, other mystery school
guys,
you know, and I don't know who's going to be doing it or not. I don't want to offend anybody or whatnot, but you'd think of the pros on this planet that just to sit and to and any little nuance, any nugget, anything that Ross Johnson has, wow, those are pearls.
Yeah,
those are pearls in a day and age when every 25-year-old British psychological illusionist has overpriced ebooks and all these things and this junk that's out there, and it's so horrible that when you get someone like that, you know, I've always been going for the teachers, and I look for teachers who at first refused to meet with me, and I would go back.
Yeah,
and I'd go back again. That's my school. Henry Fields, who was a very successful mentalist in Hollywood. He didn't want to see me at first. I tracked him down and spent time with him. Charles Scott, Sicardi, marvelous teacher of mine. And I've had so many good teachers through the years. And the thing is, I still have great teachers to this day. And a lot of them are my heroes. You know, people like Ross. Hilford is my brother. You know, we've done a lot of things together.
Bob Cassidy's got a lot of great things with the guy. Before we get off blindfolds real quick, just a quick story reminds me that I was doing a blindfold drive. I've done a couple times in a convertible. And, so that I have, had somebody in the newspaper first of all put the coins on and everything to verify. Then I put it on a hood, okay? But I remember driving in as I'm, you know, kind of weaving the car back and forth, you know. So people were sitting on the curbs and during the parade, you know, or, jumping off the curb and everything. But I just remember one guy, didn't move at all. And he kind of yelled at us, "Hey, you got the time?" And I glanced at him and watched it. Yeah, it's 3:30.
I love it. You know, and you've seen things like that with the guys with the blindfold, you know, feeling around, and all of a sudden they pick up a whole table and just move it. Like, they totally break the character of it.
Exactly.
And that's why I think, that's why the big thing in blindfold, to me, keep your eyes shut the whole time.
Sure.
While you're in there.
Until you actually
don't
see.
Until you actually, until you actually need that.
Funny you say that. You know, I do color match, you know, Frank Felicetti's.
Yeah.
And I put on a blindfold.
Great
and piece. I do that very thing, is that when I put on the blindfold, I actually close my eyes. Of course, I don't need to see for that.
Yeah.
However, that I that way I feel like I'm in more character. You really, I hadn't thought about that, but I actually do that.
Yeah. Well, and that's great. Well, it's the same thing with, you know, if you have a great deal of information that you need to regurgitate during your show, whether it be through pre-show or what have you, or serial numbers for bills and things,
right.
I like being overloaded because it looks like I'm struggling.
Mm-hmm.
You know why? Because I am.
Yeah. Same with the straitjacket. We're trying to get out of it. We're really having problems.
I am struggling to try to get that information out. I'm trying to remember it. but that's good because, but you know, it's obvious that people want to see the process of mind breaking.
Sure.
That's the difference between magic and mentalism, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
People really dig the process of mentalism as much as they do the end result.
Mm-hmm.
Why
do you think the mentalism is so popular today? And I say today because I remember years ago I'd approached Joe Stevens and said, you know, at the time, Steve Shaw, the band check, I said, you know, I want to talk about, you know, having a videotape. No, it was our cassette tape. So we had our very first thing. It was Steve Shaw's Radio Magic.
Right, and I remember that was very good.
I was trying to get Joe to market these, and he said, mentalism is not very good. You know, he said, I don't think, you know, people don't buy this, you know, kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, again, that would have been like 1987, 88, somewhere in there, you know. And now, you can't get enough of it.
Well, part of it, I think, is that Blaine blurred the lines between magic and mentalism.
Chris Angel certainly has. But
yes, he has. Yes, he has. He's blurred a lot of things. A lot of lines. But anyway, it's. I think a lot of it has to do with... You know, back in my drinking days, Eric Mead and I once emptied a bottle of Jack Daniels at my house, and the phrase we came up that night was, magic is power for the powerless. And unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with control and power. You know, what are your motives for wanting to be a magician? What are your motives for wanting to perform? What are your motives for all of this stuff?
Yeah.
Mentalism is strong. I see people's reaction. Without getting too far into the end of, you know, psychic things, which is a whole other topic for the day, I was approached by a magician recently and said, I understand, and I'll be doing a question and answer thing during the ladies-only psychic party.
Okay.
Where they come to you with real and legitimate questions and concerns.
Yeah.
And you better
They're very
love
personal.
People. Yeah. You better love people, you better care about people, and you better want to help those people.
Do you ever give negative readings? I mean, you know, there is something that's tragic that's going to happen in your life in the next 6 months, or you may have a car accident.
No, I'll give someone a warning. I said, you know, you better change your attitude about something.
Okay.
And you could, I mean, yeah, okay, that's kind of, this is a quick fix on a 8-hour topic. But, no, if someone has it coming, you know, you want to warn them about things, and you just pick that up. You know, I treat everybody like they're my sister.
Yeah.
And I care about them in that fashion. But this is the point. The magician calls me and says, I understand some women cry. I go, you mean in general? Because at this thing, you know,
during the psychic party.
I said, there are laughs, there are tears. It all depends what people are going for and what it's all about. And, you know, it's a great responsibility. It's not for the faint of heart, and I don't recommend it to anyone. And if I'm trying to keep people away from it, I said, I don't recommend it to anyone because it's difficult.
Yeah.
And your magic friends start looking at you differently and a lot of things. And think, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Sure.
So this guy, this magician says, well, can you teach me how to make women cry? I want to make someone cry at my show.
Step on their foot.
Yeah, well, I'll turn around. You're a gentleman. I was just mortified. And I'm going, you know, to the great movie True Romance, I think it's Christopher Walken, said to Dennis Hopper, this is as good as this conversation is going to get. So I think we should end it here now. But just, you know, once again, the power end of things. You know, a guy wants to make somebody cry. Why? So you can show off that this person is in tears and you're the reason.
Yeah.
What?
Did you cause elicit an emotion?
It's bizarre to me that someone would even say that. But, sorry, let me switch back to the blindfold for 1 second.
Okay.
Because this is a very big tip, too, for anybody listening. There's a great fellow who learned to do blindfold Q&A from one of my teachers, one of my great teachers. And this particular fellow also was a rep for the Anchor sound systems.
Sure.
You know, so the headset kind of microphone.
Yeah.
Well, this guy has a theater rented. You know, I don't know, it's a big theater, but he had a theater rented. You know, butts in the seats.
Yeah.
And he's going to do blindfold Q&A. Mm-hmm. He never rehearsed the Q&A wearing
The blindfold?
The microphone.
Oh, the microphone, okay.
His line of vision was directly in that little sponge ball.
Little window.
The little thing there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was what it was. It was a big black dot. And he never answered any questions.
How funny.
Oh, boy. Just goes to show you, you know, the things uh-huh. that will remember to rehearse or not remember to rehearse. And,
yeah.
Hey, and these things happen to... These things happen to the best of them.
Seems like I remember hearing from... mine just went completely blank right there. Just a second, help me out. Who did Francis Willard? Glenn Falk. So Glenn Falk
oh, yeah.
was saying, you know, as his eyesight got progressively worse, that he had to put, like, bifocals, you know, in the mask underneath
yeah.
this, so as he looked down, so he could see through the glass.
Yep.
And
he had a table lamp on that stand, and I swear that stand got higher every year.
yeah.
But, yeah.
This was the first act I saw at the Magic Castle. When I first went to the castle, it would have been Charlie McFarlane and David Fields. You know, it was back like about 81 or 82, somewhere in there.
Good
and,
company. Good company.
They were flying their private pilots for a company.
Right.
And they said, hey, we've got to go to L.A. to drop off something to be done. You want to go for dinner? We'll be back before breakfast tomorrow. And I said, perfect. And so I flew out and we had
how great
dinner
was that?
And saw Martin Nash. Bruce Servan were at the close-up
wow.
room, and then Glenn Falkenstein was working at the palace.
Wow,
yeah.
Great shows. You know, it's interesting when you go to the castle now and you look in the wine cellar, you know, directly underneath the main bar,
mm-hmm.
and you remember that was the main showroom at the Magic
Castle. Oh, gosh,
castle.
Yeah, that's right.
And the acts that were on that stage, you know, Shimada doing his bird act, and so much, and that was where it all happened.
Mm-hmm.
God, what an exciting time that must have been.
Yeah.
Gosh. Great stuff. But yeah, Glenn was a big part of that scene.
I was talking about evolution of things, you know, I'd come out to Boston to see the, you talk about the mystery, what do you call it?
Mystery Lounge.
When it was Tuesday Night Magic, you know, Monday Night Magic had been going on for a number of years.
Yeah,
Tuesday Night Magic started.
Doing that was the Green Street Grill.
Green Street Grill. That's
yeah,
got one of the posters that you had, you know,
Carter
Beats the Devil kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Steve Kredolfer, and that's when I first met David Oliver. I'm trying to remember some of the guys you were
talking about. My family there.
Yes.
Mike Bent was probably around.
I think he may have been.
Marcelo Contento, God rest
remember
his soul.
Marcelo, what a guy. Yeah.
Oh, he.
I've got one of his card fountains.
You know, we saw his wife and son recently at the David Oliver fundraiser we did last January. It was such a delight to see them. Marcelo was such a gentleman. And the way that show came together was fun. A fellow who's an amateur magician knew the people at the bar and approached Steve. And Steve is, one of my nearest and dearest. And he goes, gee, I'd like to do it if John does it with me. And I'm like, well, okay. And then we're thinking, well, if it's you and me, why don't we drag David into it with the birds? Because David could do that act anywhere. That's a big thing. A lot of people maybe knew, maybe didn't know. But David, I had him in so many awkward and odd places, on top of bar stools and corners of the odd place, and he could do that act
anywhere.
Regardless
of size.
And that was such a great testament to, when you look at some of the other, you know, the bird acts and the minute acts when they have all the things. David could do it anywhere. And so David was in that show, and all of a sudden we went, hey, how about Marcelo Contempo doing hand shadows?
Right.
Because Fu Manchu is the one who
taught him
hand shadows.
Yeah.
Because he grew up in Argentina.
Sure.
And I was like, wow. And all of a sudden it's like,
before long you got a real show there.
What a fun little thing. Yeah, and it was all, you know, it was all funky looking kind of, you know, cheap. Curtains and
I remember.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
It was on the side. It was a Chinese restaurant or something. No, was it?
No, it was
Italian.
Kind of a French Caribbean menu.
I couldn't remember.
But it was a neighborhood bar.
Yeah, on one side.
Kind of downstairs.
Yeah.
And up a couple steps into the dining room.
Yeah.
And they would just, like, you know, put up the curtain and do a show kind of thing. And funky as all get up. But boy, people wanted to be on that show. People came. At the time, Brian Gillis had a corporate client that headed to Boston once a month.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian was a regular yeah. at that day at the time. Mike Weber, David Williamson, everybody came in. And yeah. it was interesting too, because a lot of people didn't know how to be in a show.
And it was part of the variety.
And David. Yeah, and they didn't realize that, you know, I mean, a lot of guys know how to do a show, but not a lot of people know how to be in a show.
How would you differentiate that?
Well, I think it's being aware of the fact that there are other acts. It's not all about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our requisite for those shows, and still even now, Mystery Lounge, is does he or she play well with others?
Good point.
You know, you get some guys who say, no, I need all this space back. I take all this space back. I need all this.
Yeah.
I'm not going to name names, but I could. of people who are just a flipping pain in the rear end to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And they wonder,
yeah,
they
why?
Wonder why.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, it's worth it. But not in every case. And a mentor of mine once said, you know, he's a great act, but the problem is he's a perfectionist.
Yeah,
I remember directing magic show once for a magic convention, and we're dealing with people who are volunteering their time with the lights and the sound. And let's face it, you're not basically a high school auditorium.
Yeah,
there's not much to work with, and so many of these acts would say, "Okay, you know, I need an hour to rehearse." It's like, "Well, no, you don't. You've got about 10 minutes. You know, I was the taskmaster. I'm going, we got about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Because the light settings are pretty easy, on and off. You know, there's not too much to it. And one person who's still working today, I just went over to him and said, I must apologize to you, Mr. X.
Yeah.
I was under the impression you've done this act before. You know, I mean, it's like another one who's, I don't know if he's currently at Lanigan Biggs, but he goes, well, this guy only took 20 minutes. So can I have the rest of the rehearsal time? Can I have the rest of his, can I have his extra 5 minutes? What?
Wow.
You know, what do you, I mean.
Takes that long.
You know, and, but, you know, pros show up and work. They always
yeah.
have
yeah.
In this business. And the thing is, a lot of people just aren't in show business.
And you adjust to, well, that's what it's called, business.
Yeah. Well, you know, even, you know, I put myself in that category. I was very fortunate. I had great teachers, great mentors. I was on shows in the Catskills and places when I was very young. And those things were pressure, and those things were real. But, you know, what are we doing now? You know, real shows are few and far between. When I say real shows, I'm here. I'll be working in a ballroom tomorrow,
right.
As I you know you did last night, right? When
right.
I saw the pictures
right.
of you had up of your elegant setup there. And so what do? We work in hotel ballrooms,
right?
For the most of us. And well, this is show business. Well, what is it? It's what it evolved into.
Yeah, because there are no nightclubs.
And if you and I are going to Vegas to work, there's a really good chance that we're making more money.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of Penn and Teller and David Copperfield.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably making more money, well, and Mac. Mac, because Mac is involved in a whole different thing. And Mac's, you know, the greatest.
Yeah.
The greatest comedy magic act, the best constructed comedy magic act in the world, and the nicest guy attached to it in the world. I mean, I love him, and he is making money.
I'll never take anything away from Mac. Certainly deserves that. But have you seen Ray Anderson at Esther's Follies in Austin?
I hear he's been sensational.
He's my favorite.
I hear he's sensational. Nick Lewin was talking about him just the other day,
yeah.
And I've got to go see
it's
him.
Worth it. You know, when people come to Houston to visit, I will drive them to Austin just to see the show. It's that good. It's worth a 2.5-hour drive to go see the show. He is awesome.
That's what I hear.
Great guy.
That's what I hear. But the point is about Vegas is there's so many magicians there. How few are working, and how few are actually making any money.
Mm-hmm.
And
you think it's because there's so many other magicians in
part
competing in Vegas?
I think the show business is taking such a beating there.
True.
In my opinion, I honestly think that Las Vegas now sees the nightclub business as being more profitable than the shows.
The nightclub business being
these places with DJs and
And
all this type stuff.
Dance nightclub.
Yeah, kind of. And you see those places, those quote unquote celebrity places, like the, you know, like they see on TV, and you know the thing they'll do is like the Tao, the great restaurant, will turn into a whole is what young people want to do.
Right.
They'd rather do that than they'd go sit and see a show.
Right.
I guess it depends on what the show is, I suppose, but. There are so many bean counters now. You know, the concept of hospitality is not what it was in Las Vegas. And, you know, you'll have a guy in the corner who has been shining shoes for 30 years, who's a staple. I go to Vegas once a year, and I always see Charlie. You know, one of the people would say this.
Sure.
It would be part of their trip, and it would be one of the things that gave them a feeling of importance.
Sure.
And Charlie, you know, Vine Dingo would probably remember their name or their kids or something like that.
Sure.
Whoa, that guy feels like $1 million. Well, now they can make more money with a candy machine in that spot than Charlie in that spot. And the bottom line is the dollar.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whatever that guy would add to it, personality. The same thing with Disney. You know, Disney used to have great personalities. You know, like Beth Bergeron when he worked for them and stuff.
Sure.
And now it's all cookie cutter. The cruise ships. The cruise directors used to be great personalities. In so many cases, they would carry the crews, but now it's cut and dry, cookie cutter, technology, all this kind of. Hey, it's the age we live in. It's fine. I embrace it. But that being said, shows I hear in Vegas will be announced. Oh, by the way, there's a pay cut next week. What? You know, 40%.
Either going to take it or
You want to work or not?
Yeah. I guess I'll take it.
And
Jeff Hobson tell me about that. You know, and the same thing would happen with like Greek Isles. You know, it just kept getting less and less and less. And finally they said, you know, anybody who wants to come and work, just to say that you work in Vegas, you know, we'll accept all comers.
What? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
With no pay.
Oh, yeah. And there's in so much of that. And so, you know, in order to make a living, I mean, I'm on the road. I mean, you don't have to be on the road.
Yeah.
Whatever works for you. I know. I don't think you mind me saying this. I'm not going to give you dollar figures here. But my... my and your friend Michael Chow, who produced Monday Night Magic, and I got to hand it to Michael because Michael is the guy who put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah,
he brought Magic back to New York after mostly Magic closed.
Closed, right?
And
been smart successful enough to
involve the right people, and Michael works his tail off. Michael works very, very hard.
He does,
and but he's been able to take the show and let it enhance his business as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael has been able to make a darn good living as a magician.
Yeah.
As a result of being a producer of that show. You know, I guess I don't want to speak dollar amounts, but I think a lot of people would go, whoa, if they heard. But this is not the money he's making producing the magic show.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact,
there's not a lot in that, but it's, the contacts you can make. You know, if you're in the right place, and you are seen as being at a certain level, that comes back to branding, I think.
Indeed.
You know, and having the perception the magician should have, as if that, you know, that you schmooze with the best. Mm-hmm. You know, like people may not ever get to meet Bruce Willis, but the fact that you have done a card trick for Bruce Willis, and you're doing a card trick for them, well, this is the trick that Bruce Willis liked, you know, or he may have touched this very card.
And people love to hear about that.
Yes.
People love those stories. Just make sure that there's a grain of truth.
Exactly. Yeah.
A grain of truth. Always tell the truth or a variation of it.
Yeah. If you can't be sincere, then fake it. Yeah.
It's, but no, you're absolutely correct in that regard. I mean, it was like Mellini. You want to make money? You go where the money is.
Yeah,
that's what Max Mellini did.
Mm-hmm.
And with his
he was supposedly the magician to the kings and queens.
Yeah, was.
Yeah,
he was. And but his close up magic is what was fabulous.
Yeah,
you know, and Vernon and everybody said it. He would create legend and glamour. And he'd be dressed to the nines, and there was very, very few props. Even his stand-up show, there'd be very few props. But he would be selling tickets to his show, his stand-up show, which were, from all I understand, would be anticlimactic compared to a lot of the other things he did. You know, he would go, oh, the preparation, you know, talk about the plane kind of stuff. He was doing that for real.
Block of ice.
He would go to, he would pay off dry cleaners in Washington, D.C., and this is Senator so-and-so's tailcoat? Great. Sew the six of spades into the lining. You know, and he had the, and there was all, this is the great collectible I'd love to have. Bellini's notebooks as to where cards were hidden.
No, they were never
different
used.
Homes, different homes, different, the fact that he had this, and he knew, Senator so-and-so, okay, he's got the five of clubs in the coat of that jacket. I'm going to go over and do a freaking mirror.
If you knew that, yeah.
But also know what... You
David
Berglas
is another one who does that today.
But you have to, and Gerard Senehe is like that as well. But you also have to know what to do with that five spades in the coat.
To make it into that miracle.
To make it a miracle. The same way, you know, the old story of the magician shuffling the deck of cards and knowing that the seven of hearts is on top and asks you to name a card.
Right.
Seven of hearts. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now you got to be ice. You got to be so cool. And you got to do it because the little magician inside is getting, getting a little...
That's right.
Chubby in his pants, and the table's knocking over, and he's sweating, and then he'll start saying stuff like, "Now you're sure, right? You had a free choice. I didn't say anything. You don't want to change your mind." Okay, I do. The magician will talk himself out of the miracle.
Sure.
But it's, it's just how does the card get in there? What's the route that ends up the card being inside the guy, the lining of the guy's coat? You're all set to do a miracle. You're teed up to do a miracle. The same way, you know, a great golfer is teed up to make a shot, but you still got to make that shot.
Wow, that's a great analogy.
You still got to make that shot.
You still got to wind up and you got to take the swing.
Yeah.
And, what is it that makes it the perfect shot as opposed to shanking it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The moment, timing, conditioning, a lifetime's worth of preparation wrapped up into this very moment and living in that moment. Totally living in the moment, totally enjoying it. There are some things that I've been playing with that have been kind of miracle class kind of things with a lot of advanced preparation. As of late, I have been dipping my toe in that pool a little more.
Yeah.
First of all, I love it. I enjoy it. It's just things with a lot more advanced preparation. But once again, how do you execute at that stage? You know, I'll hear if someone else is using the same tool, and they'll say, "Well, I didn't get anything out of it." And what did you do? And they may have confused it. I was with Bill Hurst recently, and we saw close to being the worst magic show I've ever seen in my life. And it was a young guy at a comedy club doing a regular show in a tourist area, and he totally ruined all these like cookie cutter effects we were talking about before.
Right.
He would ruin them by trying to improve them, and he didn't understand the concept of a lot of the magic. I was never really good at anything until I found magic. Next thing you know, there's shaving cream flying through the air and stuff. Next thing you know, it's snowing. Hey, look, if it works for you, fine. Yeah. But you gotta be able to sell that. This guy's going like, I was on Star Search when I was six. I had magic licked. There was nowhere for me to go. So then I became a star athlete in school. Then I came back to magic. Oh, I want to love this guy. I want to embrace him, boy. Like, I just turned to Bill halfway through the show. I feel like I'm insane. I just totally feel like I'm insane. And the audience was,
this guy's my peer.
Well, that's just everybody assumes they're your peer.
Yeah.
And I respectfully want to say, in years ago, I would say, you may have a better spiritual life than I. You may have more money in the bank. You may have a better home life than I do. But you've not been bloodied in battle the way I have.
Yeah,
I have nothing but such great respect for those guys in my neighborhood when I was growing up, who were a little older than I were, who went to Vietnam.
Yeah,
and I sat when they came back and I drank with them. And a lot of these guys were
messed up, and I'm sure you know these guys.
Yeah.
And then they came back and they were treated the way they were treated.
Yeah.
But without getting into, you know, all of that, it's like, I wasn't there. I can't pretend for a moment.
Empathize.
You know?
Yeah, right.
I wasn't on the road with Howard Thurston. I can't pretend I was there.
Yeah.
You know, magic's very interesting because I don't know of any, you know, part-time heart surgeons.
Yeah.
That's not to say that so many practitioners of magic will be more professional, have more elegant presentations, and just be a great, great act for one reason or another.
You know,
that's someone who does this for a living.
Well, you know what they call the person who was the last in their graduating class for being a heart surgeon? They still call him doctor.
Wow.
Stan Allen called me. Hold on just a second here. Let me pause this by
That's a sound of a phone call from Stan Allen.
Yeah, that's right. yeah, from Doctor Who.
The ring is louder than Stan.
Okay.
But,
have to get back in. Sorry to mute my phone over there.
It's all good.
There was something else that you kind of touched on earlier that kind of made me think about the story about Picasso. You know, about talk about Lifetime, which that there was a lady who had asked if she could have him draw a portrait of her. You know, saw him in a restaurant or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was a stroke of a pen, you know, one stroke. You know, that he had, you know, made a you know, picture of this lady, and she said that epitomizes me. That's perfect. That's great. Thank you very much. How much do I owe you? $5,000. $5,000. Just for nothing more than just a stroke of the pen that didn't take you a moment to complete. I said, no, it took me a lifetime to complete.
That's it. And that's what it is with all of us. I don't care how old you are. I don't care how long you've been doing it. That's the answer.
Yeah,
because as we were speaking of before, I think we were off mic. We were talking about the concept of competition and other people and how you handle this type of thing in business and whatnot. And my whole feeling was inspired by Bobby Knight, the basketball coach,
mm-hmm.
when he had asked his players, what did they compete against. What are you competing against? And, of course, you know, he had that reputation of being this bully, and you saw he was a rough guy. And when I heard this, it changed my perception of him.
Yeah.
And he basically said you were competing against your own potential. And that's all any of us are doing. So if you've been into this for 6 months, you might have something very special going on. And the only thing you're competing against is your own potential. The same thing for guys like us who have been kicking around this stuff for, you know, 40 years. You know, we're still just competing against our own potential. So I never want to look over my shoulder, and I don't want to pretend that there is anyone else. I know that could be taken as an ego statement, but I think it's much more healthy than not. There is nobody but me. And so why should we be looking over our shoulders and talking about other guys and stuff? Someone sees, you know, it's always been said, he who does card and wallet last wins, you know. The last magician they saw, in most cases, is the greatest magician they saw.
Isn't that the darn truth? You know, whenever that people say, well, you're the best magician I've ever seen, you know, you always hate to ask the next leading question, well, how many have you seen?
Well, but
like you said about nuns, there's so few.
Before, it was Bill Goldman who brought this up. What are there, more magicians or more nuns?
Yeah.
Was a question he asked years ago. And it was a kind of an interesting question. And then his response was, well, when's the last time you've seen a nun?
Yeah.
You know, we don't, we think this every day.
Mm-hmm.
The average person doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, the average person will wake up and say, gee, I want to see an ace assembly. You know, I mean, you know, it's just like, it's the furthest thing from their mind.
Yeah.
You know, the same way when you talk about an exposure or something, it's as insignificant as dirt in the bottom of their shoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless they're... have that hard interest that we have,
right?
Kind of thing. And even if they see one of these exposure things or whatever, it's like, I think it's easily forgotten,
mm-hmm.
in most cases, unless there's an interest to begin with. And
you know, you were talking about the Masked Magician who was on, that it didn't bother you.
No. Mm-hmm. I mean, did I like it? No, I didn't like it.
Right.
You know, I didn't approve of the concept. But magicians were feeding into, Fox was waving a red cape,
yeah,
with all its local affiliates, having them going around all the news to create a buzz about the show.
Yeah, it's controversy.
When it was on originally, mm-hmm, it was the highest rated entertainment special that Fox ever had.
The first one that came out, then it went down.
Yeah,
steadily.
Rated. Yeah, and the highest rated something else was the highest rated magic show,
mm-hmm,
and the highest rated entertainment show that Fox ever had.
I remember whenever that came out, there was even a front page article in the Wall Street Journal, and I believe Walter Blaney, who was president of World Alliance of Magicians at the time, was questioned about that, and he was one, you know, who was
right,
really involved with that and saying,
right,
you know, it was a bad,
oh,
deal. So he really, really fed into that.
Yeah. And he
said everything that they wanted to hear.
And I see how it happened. The same. The marketing was the same with Penn and Teller.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were doing. They were waving a red shirt when they were the bad boys of magic.
Yep, right.
And people were saying they exposed. And it's, you know, I mean, I think anybody, what you like Penn and Teller, you don't like Penn and Teller, I think anybody interested in magic can go see their show, or any magician can go see their show, and be more consistently fooled than they are at any other magic show.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great magic show.
It is.
And, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
The same way now, I'm thrilled that David Copperfield is introducing new material and stuff.
Oh yeah,
it's, you know, the greatest collaborative presentation of magic ever done.
And he has changed also. It's interesting. I just spoke with Jody Spina, and we were talking about choreographing his show for so many years, from 85 to 96. And I was asking about whether, you know, who does it now, and she said nobody. You know, he doesn't have dancers in his show currently, you know, the way that he did before.
Yeah.
So he's kind of evolved from one thing to another.
Sure.
Not that it was bad,
yeah,
not that it is still, or
yeah,
whatever, it's just that it's not, yeah, something that people do.
Just sidebar for a second, I understand that David was just very, very good with Joni.
He was.
He was very
forthcoming with finances. He apparently did not know the severity of her prognosis, mm-hmm, you know, that she had apparently lymphoma, cancer. She's now 5 years cancer-free, but she's trying to get onto the lung transplant list,
yeah,
but they can't until that she's been,
yeah,
cancer-free for a period of time. But because of how ill that she's been after one complication or another, that,
sure,
she hasn't been able to work, and so she's been, you know, bad. And so she was going to go back to Boston area, which were, you know,
yeah,
they,
I don't know, I think she was there for a while.
Yeah,
yeah.
Then Stan Allen had put together, and his wife, some sort of a benefit, you know, for her. And Copperfield, you know, came, found out about this and was unaware of it. And as a result, you know, it's a, what can I do, you know? And she said that, without getting into the details, just basically, you know, I no longer have financial stress in my life to complicate all the rest of things. She said that I'm good for, you know, a year right now, for another year, you know, for my house payments or whatever else. So it's just, what a guy.
That's,
you know,
fabulous.
It's not something that, you know, you,
yeah,
know, who talks about. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
what a guy.
You know, there, that's another great thing. There's so many good people in magic who rally around one another.
Like with David Oliver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, David's my brother, and to see him, just everybody. Everybody came to the fore, and the nice thing is that most people were working together on it, and it was a very beautiful thing, and it's ongoing. People are still doing things for him,
sure,
and whatnot, but so many people, you know, like, you know, you hear these things that, well, you don't hear about a lot of them, probably. Just solids that guys like Lance Burke would do for people. And, it's just nice. It's just very nice. There still is a good sense of community out there, and you see a lot of people helping one another.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's beautiful. I think it's a really good thing.
We are in a very nice community. And it's been a nice conversation. I'm going to start to
nice
kind of wrap this up over here. I think I may have asked you before about your magic word, since my podcast is called The Magic Word. What is yours? What's your philosophy of life? What's important to John Stetson?
Living in the moment is what's most important to me. You live in the moment, it's impossible to be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
if you're depressed, you're just projecting backwards, whether it be
projecting
30 seconds, 30 years, 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Stress, anxiety, that means you're projecting forward. And only when you're living in this moment can you accept things. Can you be at peace? Am I there all the time? No way.
Yeah.
But I love a book called The Four Agreements. I like to think that magicians should take a little look at that.
The Four Agreements.
Four Agreements.
By
someone who, I'm choking on my drink over here. I'm drawing a complete and total mental blank. Sorry, I live it. I don't read it. But it is, it's four very, very simple points. Mm-hmm. And one is really being impeccable with your word. The most important thing is to not take things personally.
Just
don't want to take things personally in this lifetime, because it's somebody else's. Mm-hmm. When we're upset,
things are said.
Things are said, and so I don't like to take things personally. I want to be true to my word, true to myself, and just honesty. Self words I was talking about before: self awareness, self reliance. Self-respect, and along with that goes self-love and self-embrace. Mm-hmm. Because I just don't think that there's enough, not to be confused with crazy egos. I think a lot of the crazy egos we see are people who actually hate themselves.
Yeah.
But I mean, truly loving yourself, being comfortable in who you are and your skin, and allowing you to enjoy this beautiful gift that we have been given. And that's a passion.
Yeah.
For us to have a passion. How many people do not have a passion in this life?
Way too many. Way too many people don't really enjoy their job, their situation, their location. They're just upset all the time, and looking for that next thing that will make them happy. And if you're looking for something to make you happy, you never find it.
With the magic, I always joke and say, nothing has given me more pleasure and caused me more pain in my entire life. But it's true. But it's because I love it.
Yeah.
And I'm saying I love it more than anybody. I'm just saying I think I love it as much as anybody ever has.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've made a few, I might call them sacrifices, but they're choices that I made.
Sure.
We all make choices.
Sure.
And I've made some choices. Some of them were rather inelegant. But I'm pleased with the choices I made. I love baseball. I love playing with my computers. I love my dogs.
Yeah.
I'm blessed to have been married for 30 years.
Yeah.
November 11th. And you want to know? 30 years. Probably a mind mentioned roasting Bob Cassidy that day.
On your anniversary, 30th anniversary.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's not going to come out there with you?
No.
Okay. She'll just be with you in spirit.
But there are great things. There are great things in my life that I'm very passionate about, and that I'm just very, very fortunate for all of them. And it's a blessing. And
well, we're fortunate in magic and to have you in this to make it better for all of us, because people are seeing good magic done well, and so that way that they're going to hire other magicians, keep our lives saying, I saw a guy one time that read my mind. I know he did. It was Stetson. It looked like a hat. Same with Stetson. You know that guy?
Like a toilet and a hat. I understand. John Stetson.
We were talking about the Mindvention a little bit earlier.
Yes.
And you're planning on attending the Mindvention
again
this
year? I will
be.
They're honoring Bob Cassidy.
Yeah.
So that's a must. Bob's the greatest. And there's going to be a roast. And I think I have to
roast
to be involved.
Are you not the roast master, are you?
No, but I will be one of the roasters. I believe.
Okay.
So that'll be fun.
They used to do those at the 4F convention so many years ago, and they were always great. And they just cut loose. Jay Marshall was like the roast master.
Yeah.
And I remember there was one done with Tom Mullica, and in which Jay had said something about Tom, hating to leave his friends behind or something, And there were so many gay jokes and things. And now this would have been in the mid-80s sometime, at that time, when Tom finally got to speak, he said, for those of you who didn't know, at least now you do know. But when it came time for Gary Ouellette to be the guest of honor. That's when they just, you know, that Obi said, okay, we're not going to be doing the roast in the traditional sense. This is going to be more of an honor, you know, kind of a thing, because he was a very classy guy.
Yeah.
And so he didn't want
a little more,
apropos. Exactly. So it was done a little bit differently. So anyhow, you're going to be, talking about Bob Cassidy and my invention. And
yeah, we'll be there. And yeah. I know, Doc Hilford will be there. So we'll be having, having some laughs, but we're doing something really fun right after my invention. Bob Kohler is a great pal, and what a lot of people don't know about Bob, as well as being a great magician, Bob's a great mentalist. And Bob did a mental act for many years in the corporate scene, and did very, very well with it.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, when Tim Conover was constructing his act, Bob was his sounding board, and they created a lot of that material together.
Wow.
Yeah,
did not know that.
And so Bob is doing a little teaching session.
Okay.
And I am honored that he asked me to sit first chair with him there.
Wow.
And so we're going to be doing this together, I guess a couple days right after the Mind Convention.
After the Mind Convention. Okay.
Right after the convention. And we're going to be going over a lot of stuff. We're going to be, it's going to be a lot of, mention of Tim Conover's material, some of my involvement with the development of the Neil Schreyer material that's out there and been very, very popular these days. We're also going to talk on some particular Q&A techniques, both close-up and stage. And we're really going to run all the way through, and also basically explain to people how they can maybe make a couple of dollars doing some mentalism.
Yeah.
Which is always nice. There's nothing else to help support this
to buy more
habit
stuff.
You've created. Yeah.
To buy more of Pro Mystics and all the electronics.
Yeah, stuff. But it's going to be really, really good. Bob is a great teacher.
Right.
So technically savvy with not just his magic and his mentalism, but of course the internet in general and all this type of you know, various and sundry things that we're going to be putting into this presentation that we're really just percolating with it right now, and it's exciting. I'm looking forward to it, because, to tell you the gosh honest truth, I know not only am I going to be teaching a lot, but I'm going to be learning a lot.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a great experience, limited to just a few guys.
That's not to be confused with the Mystery School, because they usually
Mystery School is doing their mentalism over the same period.
Okay.
But from what I understand, they are sold out. Now, there may be a chair available. What happens sometimes is people will buy these seats, and then for one reason or another have to back out, or, you know, for who knows what. So I'm not saying don't contact Jeff if you're at that interest. And I know Ross Johnson will be taking part in Jeff's
deal
as well. And it's unfortunate. Originally, we wanted to do it before Mindvention, but I had a series of corporate jobs come in that I had to take. And unfortunately, the real estate in Las Vegas around these magic events is not plentiful.
Yeah, limited. Okay.
So there's only a certain amount of time, you know, before and after the Magic Lives and whatnot to do this. Bob's also done, he did a fabulous one, a gambling one, not too long ago. And that fellow Rod the Hop was involved. And
Rod the Hop?
Yeah, he's ill. He's... but he's a real deal card guy, and wow, I can't say enough about he and his technique and whatever. And so Bob is aces in the gambling area.
Yeah.
He also is doing some things with Armando.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing some teaching. And Bob has been teaching people in Las Vegas for a number of years, but it's more or less been one-on-one. So this is the first time it's going to be... Well,
class.
I shouldn't say the first time, because he's been doing... He did the gambling one and this other. But
how do people sign up for that? Where they
Bob, I believe it's Bob Kohler Magic.
Okay, K-O-E-H-L-E-R.
That sounds right to me. And I am John, J-O-N, at johnstetson.com. Please... if you want to send me an email, use that address and not the website, because the website goes right to management. Management's sole purpose in life is to keep people away from me. So so that is my
Please
personal
contact
email.
You directly.
Yes, if you have any questions about anything and don't want to know more about the thing that Bob and I are doing, that would be great. So hopefully we'll see some of our listeners there.
So thank you for doing what you do.
It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure. It's always great to speak with you.
Always,
Scott.
John.
You're one of the good guys.
back at you. All right, that was John Stetson. We've had a pretty good dinner. Thank you guys for joining us over here then on the Magic Word Podcast. For now, John Stetson and Scotty out.
Hi, Scotty here again. Do you like the Magic Word Podcast? If you do, you can help us by liking us on the Facebook page for the Magic Word Podcast. Or you can also just leave a comment here on the MagicWordPodcast.com website. Or if you're downloading through iTunes, please leave a comment and favorable ratings there on the iTunes Store. As always, it would be extremely helpful and deeply appreciative if you could leave a donation via PayPal. If you just go to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com, up on the top left hand of the splash page, you will see a button for donate now. It would be awfully helpful to keep the doors open and our microphone running and help us to deliver quality podcasting material about magicians, for magicians, by a magician, here on themagicwordpodcast.com. Thank you, however you choose to support us, because we certainly appreciate it. For now, Scotty out.